I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Ta-Nehisi Coates grew up on Baltimore's drug-ravaged West Side. Now, the former Time magazine staff writer has put his life story to paper. NPR's Farai Chidea sat down with Coates to talk about his new book, The Beautiful Struggle.
Ta-Nehisi Coates grew up in the harsh landscape of late 80s Baltimore, where every day can be a struggle. But luckily, his father, a former Black Panther and radical book publisher, gave him the tough love he needed to succeed. Ta-Nehisi went from being a mediocre student to a writer who's worked for The Village Voice and Time magazine. Ta-Nehisi Coates explores his unconventional childhood and road to self-discovery in The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and the Unlikely Road to Manhood. So you've written for so many different publications, some of the best in the country, and you've been telling other people's stories and writing about public incidents. And when did you realize that your own story needed some attention?
I don't know if I ever realized that. I just, you know, felt a great need to write it. I don't know how much attention I felt it deserved. In more direct answer to your question, I mean, I've been, you know, writing about myself and writing about doing personal essays since I started my journalism career. I mean, one of the first, I guess second or third articles I ever did was about going to the West Coast with my dad for a Panther reunion. I think it was the 30th anniversary, I believe. So it was very natural to transition into a book and to do a memoir.
Tell us a little bit about your father, who's very well known in some circles and not so much in others. I mean, he's been a real stalwart in the idea of preserving African and African-American history.
Yeah, my dad is a publisher in Baltimore. Started his own publishing company in the late 70s. Was a former Black Panther, Vietnam vet, father of seven kids by four women. I swear I have this all down pat now. More than anything, a very, very caring man. And, you know, in reference to the book, an extremely caring father.
I have to ask you, what does he think about the book?
Oh, you know, he has his criticisms, but his criticisms are not what you would think they would be. In other words, his criticisms are not content criticisms. I mean, you know, as I explained in the book, I was raised around, you know, books. I was raised around reading. My father's a very literary person. So his criticisms are very stylistic. You know, why did you write this way? Why couldn't you do this? Couldn't you use less N-words? Why you got to write this? You know, it's that sort of thing. We didn't go through it too much over what you would think we would go through it over, i.e., you know, why do you have to say this about me? That wasn't too much a part of our dialogue.
So most of the book takes place between junior high school and, you know, you entering college. Tell us a little bit about who you were as a kid, what kind of person you were.
Someone who would have much rather spent their childhood in their room reading comic books and playing Dungeons and Dragons. That's who I was. Although, you know, it's very interesting. When I saw the first press that my publishing company was preparing for the book, you know, they were like, Ta-Nehisi Coates was a young, nerdy kid in West Baltimore. And I never thought that fit because by the same token, I was very much into sports. I loved football. But I was not, as, you know, the rappers say, I was not built for the streets. I guess that's the best way to put it. That was probably the best description of myself. But, you know, a large part of the book is about how you get remade for the streets or else.
You also talk about the way that your brother was, if not built for the streets, he definitely remade himself for the streets. Tell us about your brother and how you guys are different.
My brother, you know, and even to this day, you know, he's always been a much more direct, stubborn, I'm going to do it this way, you know, sort of person. And I guess I've always been sort of stubborn too, but I'm much more quiet, much more reserved about my stubbornness. I'm a little bit more deliberative. But by the same token, you know, my brother is, you know, one of the most loyal people you could ever know. One of these people who, if you're in a bar fight, you would really want him there with you as opposed to against you.
Big Bill. That's
Big
a great,
Bill.
Great name, yes, for an older brother.
Yes.
And you guys, you start off with a sequence where you guys have to deal with some other folks who are rolling up on you.
Right.
What did it do to you to realize that your physical safety was not assured from the time that you were a preteen?
I'm glad you asked that question because I think if there's, you know, that's probably the biggest theme of the book. And I think if there's one thing that people underestimate about black kids and black boys going to school in cities, they really underestimate how violence completely changes how you look at everything. It's very hard to sit in class. And I'm, you know, even if I had been, you know, a white kid out, you know, wherever I would have been, I don't know that I would have been much different. You know, I didn't do well at school and I, you know, had really, really good parents. But having said that, I think people really underestimate how violence just completely reorients how little black boys and, you know, as they grow to, you know, bigger black boys and into black men, look at life, look at school. I mean, if one of your big concerns about getting to school is how to get there safely, I wonder how much time you're going to have to think about algebra, to think about Shakespeare.
What about your friend Fruity, who was someone who took a different approach to trying to deal with the violence than you? How did you each approach that issue?
Fruity was a lot like me, but I think something happened earlier in his life where it became very clear to him that there's a time to negotiate and there's some things that just can't be negotiated, you know? And he was one of these guys who... when he was threatened, his, you know, response was always, you know, self-defense. And he didn't care how many people it was because, you know, he understood. I was, and as I portray myself in the book, you know, I was much more of a talker. You know, I wanted to talk my way. I would have, you know, done anything to avoid conflict. And what he taught me, and this has really been a life lesson, some conflicts, you know, they can't be avoided. I mean, it's like that great Churchill quote, you know, you sought to avoid war and disgrace, and now you'll have both. I'm getting that wrong, but it's paraphrased. It's something like that. And he understood that as a 12-year-old boy.
Your father was in the struggle, but a different kind of struggle. As a Black Panther, as a book publisher, what do you make of his struggle? How did you relate to it as a kid, first of all?
Initially, not particularly well. Because I felt like his struggle was basically one in which he made me do as much work as possible. As a child, you just, you know, adults try to explain things to you, but you have so many questions. And, you know, to cut on the TV and to see, you know, One World and how things are going. I mean, this is the age of Reagan. And whenever, you know, people talk about Reagan, whenever the rest of America talks about Reagan, it's very clear that they have a different memory of those years than what black folks who lived in cities have. Of those years. And so you cut on the TV and you see one reality and you walk outside and you see a completely different reality. My dad's struggle, the sort of consciousness that he was trying to bring forth, the books that were in my house, the histories of the Black Panther, the Black Power movement, Malcolm X, all of that stuff. It was a, and I don't say this in any sort of berating way, it was a mythology for me. It was a way to explain. It was religion. I was in a house in which we didn't really have religion. We weren't Christian, Muslim, or anything. We didn't even celebrate Kwanzaa. And so it's sort of left to you to create a way of understanding the world. And that's what mythology, that's what religion gives us. And that was what that was for me. You know, one of the things about this book is, you know, people always ask me, how could you, you know, lay, you know, so much out there? But I did it. And I especially did that in a deep-seated belief that all people struggle with these things. Now, you know, most people's fathers may not have 7 kids by 4 women, but people have things in their past. I mean, and it's one of the things I learned as a journalist. It was never a moment that I spent interviewing somebody over a long period of time that they did not, you know, begin to tell me something about their past that made you go, what? You know, and so that gave me great freedom when it came to write, because I knew that I really didn't have anything to be ashamed of. That, in fact, what I expected was that a lot of people, or what I hoped was that a lot of people would see the book, read this, and be attracted to the humanity of it.
Well, Ta-Nehisi, thanks.
Thank you.
That was NPR's host Farai Chidea speaking with Ta-Nehisi Coates. He just wrote a book called The Beautiful Struggle, and he joined us from our NPR studios in New York City.